The Faith of Abraham in Paul and James, the sixth talk in a series titled Reading the Book, Lessons in Understanding the Bible, was presented by Ron Julian on May 8, 2001, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
Okay. We're continuing in our series called Reading the Book, where we've been trying to pick certain passages to illustrate various points about what we think are significant issues that we face when we read the Bible, things that we need to keep in mind, skills that we need to develop, issues that we need to keep in mind as we approach the Bible. Let me just review for you really quickly some of the things that I've talked about so far. We started out talking about the importance of recognizing that a biblical text is usually written in a particular situation, a particular historical situation. The letters, for instance, are written to particular people in a particular setting, and we need to be careful to try to understand as much as we can what was the situation into which they're writing. That can have a big impact on how we understand what the text is saying. I reminded us that the text was not written to us specifically as the primary audience. When Paul wrote to the Corinthians, he was writing to the Corinthians. And it's important for us to recognize in those kind of situations that we're not the ones being addressed. And sometimes a phrase like, we do something, I pointed out that that doesn't always mean we Christians, that we're talking about trying to discover what it is the author actually had in mind, which may or may not mean all of us as Christians. Then the next point I made was that it is very important for us to pay attention to the flow of thought through a passage, that very often we as Christians pull out a little section and say, well, this is the section that talks about rewards or spiritual gifts or whatever, and we need to make sure that we actually back up and read the whole thing in context, paying attention to the flow of thought, what is the argument that it is a part of. We spent 1 week looking at a parable where I tried to point out that we need to distinguish between the story itself that Jesus told and the point that the story was making, and then any commentary by Jesus or by Luke or Matthew or whoever that might be saying something about and around that story. And we looked at a particular parable to try to sort out what was the story saying, what did the comment around it tell us about that story. And then last week, we talked a little bit about the importance of paying attention to the original language. In the New Testament, it was written in Greek, and I said that we actually, as modern readers, have pretty easy access. If we want to find it, we have pretty easy access to information about the Greek. Even if we don't know Greek, we can find out things about what the particular words were behind the text and other places that they're used, and that information can be very helpful and is essential, really, at times for us to be able to deal with the text, because it wasn't written in English. It was written in Greek and Hebrew and Aramaic. Okay, today I want to take us to another passage. Actually, we're going to be wandering around a number of places here, but the point that I want to emphasize today centers really around two passages in the New Testament. You're probably familiar. You may have encountered the fact that in the book of Romans, it says, Paul says, that we are justified by faith and not by works of the law. He says that in chapter 3 of Romans. You may also be aware that in James' letter, he says that we're justified by works and not by faith alone. So we have this problem right off the bat, is that it seems like these two texts are saying exactly the opposite of each other. And for myself, that was really troubling to me as a young Christian. In fact, I can remember in my younger, quite cocky and sure of myself days. Believe it or not, there was a time when I was more cocky and sure of myself than I am today. And I can remember having a very suspicious attitude towards the inerrancy of the Bible. Even though I was a believer, I was having a real hard time buying the idea that the Bible always got it right. And one of the things that I really thought about a lot was the fact that Paul said we're justified by faith, and James said we're justified by works, and I didn't see how you could put those two things together. So when I started to become more of a student of the Bible, one of the first issues that I wanted to deal with was, what is it that James was saying, what is it that Paul was saying, and was there some way of reconciling them? And I was really particularly concerned. I didn't want to just come up with some really twisty, oh, well, if we really, really force it, we might be able to find a way of explaining how they work together. I really wanted to be able to look at what Paul was saying in Romans, read it there in context, and say, yes, he's saying this, and to look at what James was saying in context and put his argument together and say, yes, he's saying this, and to have those two things match, to have those two things work together. Well, when I started to look into this issue, one of the things that I noticed, it's one of the things that drives you crazy when you first start to try to wrestle with these passages, is that both of them quote the same passage in the Old Testament in making their point. In Romans, after he says that we're justified by faith and not by works of the law, he goes on to say, "What then shall we say that Abraham, our forefather, according to the flesh, has found? For if Abraham was justified by works, he has something to boast about, but not before God. For what does the Scripture say?" And now here's the quote. "And Abraham believed God, and it was reckoned to him as righteousness. Now to the one who works, his wage is not reckoned as a favor, but as what is due. But to the one who does not work, but believes in him who justifies the ungodly, his faith is reckoned as righteousness." So Paul is hammering the point. It is justification by faith, not by works. And he quotes this passage. "Abraham believed God, and it was reckoned to him as righteousness." Okay, well, now we look at what James has to say. And James, in making his point, says, "Was not Abraham our father justified by works when he offered up Isaac his son on the altar? You see that faith was working with his works, and as a result of the works, faith was perfected, and the Scripture was fulfilled, which says, 'And Abraham believed God, and it was reckoned to him as righteousness, and he was called the friend of God.' You see that a man is justified by works and not by faith alone." Well, what was very interesting is that one passage from Genesis 15 is quoted both by Paul and by James to make their points that seem to be, at first glance, opposite points. The issue that I want to talk about tonight, the passages that we're talking about here have a lot involved with them, and there is more involved with them than we are going to be able to talk about. But the point that I particularly wanted to emphasize tonight is that we, as students of the New Testament, what I'm talking about now is reading the New Testament, as we're doing here when we're reading Paul's letter to the Romans and this letter that James wrote to various churches. When we're reading the New Testament, the Old Testament is very often quoted by the New Testament writers. It happens all the time. Most translations these days put it in all capital letters or bold or something like that so that you can tell this is a quote from the Old Testament. The funny thing about it, the striking thing about us as readers of the New Testament is, I just know from my own experience and from hanging around with people who have been Christians for a long time, that one of the traps that we fall into is we might sit and hammer on what's Paul doing in Romans and what's James doing in James and really wrestle with this and try to fit together what it's doing and never, ever actually go back and look at the Old Testament passage that they're quoting. So the point I would like you to come away with tonight, which I think is a very important one, it's very commonsensical, very simple one. It can get very complex in applying it. But the point that I want to make is, when we find the New Testament authors using the Old Testament, we can't really understand their point until we go back and figure out what the point was of the stuff that they're referring to. So what I would like to do tonight is to take you back and talk a little bit about the Old Testament picture of the life of Abraham, because it is that is informing both of these texts. Both Paul in Romans 3 and 4 and James in chapter 2, both of them are referring back to the life of Abraham. Paul refers to this time when he believed God and it was reckoned to him as righteousness. James refers to that as well, but he also refers to this event where Abraham was willing to offer up Isaac, his son, as a sacrifice before God. So, if we're going to understand the connection between those things and the ideas in these texts, then we're going to have to go back and take a look at what was going on there. That's the point that I want you to come away with. If nothing else tonight, if I don't convince you of how we ought to think about the faith and works issue in Paul and James, although actually I wouldn't mind doing that because I think the issue is an important one and I actually am pretty confident. You know, I've had varying levels of confidence at various issues that we've talked about. I'm actually pretty confident that what I'm going to argue for tonight is in fact what Paul and James have in mind regarding this stuff. But never mind that. That's a secondary bonus, is that you're going to learn all about how faith and works work together and your entire Christian experience is going to be transformed. My main point tonight is to show you this as an example, is that if the New Testament passage that I'm trying to understand is dealing with the Old Testament, then I had better get back and try to deal with the Old Testament as well. And that means, unfortunately, that the process of understanding the particular text I'm looking at can get more complicated than I would like it to be. Part of the reason I don't go back and look at the Old Testament is the Old Testament is even harder to understand than the New Testament is, and I'm just multiplying my problems, aren't I? Aren't I just making this harder? Well, in a way, I'm making it longer. I have more to do in this process. But in fact, in the end, it may be the very key that helps to unlock the passages. Not that it's always going to be that way, but this is always an important step to go back and figure out what the Old Testament is doing. Now, there's so much involved in these passages with Abraham. I'm going to just sort of give you a little tour through them, a very highly selective tour, and I'm going to argue for a certain thing that really deserves more than what we can look at tonight. But I want to give this as an example of the sort of thing that I'm talking about. You would want to go back and look this over with more care than we're going to be able to go at tonight. But this, as I say, will, I hope, serve as an example of the kind of thing that I'm talking about. In order to understand the two events in Abraham's life that James refers to, we need to kind of back up and get an overview of his life, I would say. I want to start with the fact that God, in a very famous passage in Genesis 12, makes a promise to Abraham. Now the Lord said to Abram, "Go forth from your country and from your relatives and from your father's house to the land which I will show you, and I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, and so you shall be a blessing. And I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you I will curse, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. You will hear people refer to this as the Abrahamic covenant. This is the agreement that God is making with Abraham, the promise he's making of what he's going to do. He's going to give him a land. He is going to make him a great nation. And he is going to receive a blessing himself. And he is going to be a blessing to all the families of the earth, all of the nations of the earth. It's an incredible promise that God is making. And really, when we go and look at the whole picture of what the Bible is saying, this promise is almost like a capsule summary of what the entire rest of the Bible goes on to talk about. You could argue that the rest of the Bible is about how God is setting about fulfilling this promise that he made to Abraham. The New Testament authors certainly argue that way, that this blessing that was promised to Abraham is the very blessing that Jesus is bringing about. And the blessing to all of the families of the earth, all of the nations of the earth, that is fulfilled in what Jesus did, and so on. So, I mean, it's a vast picture. But in Abraham's terms, he's looking at this, and God has made a promise to him. There is a land I am giving to you. You are going to have a whole nation of people that are going to come from you, and you're going to end up being a blessing to all the nations, and you will be blessed yourself. So, having received this promise from God, Abraham acts on it, takes his wife, his nephew, and they set out for the land of Canaan, this land that God had promised to Abraham. Now, after he's been in the land for a while and had various adventures and done various significant things, we read about in Genesis 15, after these things, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision, saying, "Do not fear, Abram. I am a shield to you. Your reward shall be very great." And Abram said, "O Lord God, what will you give me, since I am childless, and the heir of my house is Eliezer of Damascus?" And Abram said, "Since you have given no offspring to me, one born in my house is my heir." The Old Testament is sort of cryptic as it goes along. A lot of times the authors don't explain a whole lot of what's happening. But it's probably not too hard to see what's going on in Abraham's mind here. God has made him a promise that he is going to be a great nation. The idea there is, I have children, and those children have children, and so on, and from me comes this great nation that you've promised. Well, you made a promise of blessing before God, and here you are saying, I'm going to bless you. Your reward is going to be very great for following me. And Abram here is sort of reminding God, you know, I don't quite see how this is going to work, because you said I'm going to be this great nation, but the fact is I don't have any kids. And the way I figure it, in order to found a great nation, you need to have at least like one kid. And I don't have any. Right now, I have Eliezer of Damascus is who's going to inherit my stuff when I die. I don't have a kid that to pass on my inheritance, my blessing to. I've got nobody. God responds to him by saying, "Then behold, the word of the Lord came to him saying, 'This man will not be your heir, but one who shall come forth from your own body, he shall be your heir.' And he took him outside and said, 'Now look toward the heavens and count the stars, if you are able to count them.' And he said to him, 'So shall your descendants be.'" So, Abraham has said, "Look, I don't get this. You've made this big promise, but I don't see how this can be." God says to him, No. It's not going to be this guy who's technically your heir. You are going to have a child from your own body. You are going to father a child. And that child is going to become the beginning of this great nation. Look toward the heavens and count the stars if you are able to count them. So shall your descendants be. So don't worry. I'm promising you. You are going to have a child from your own body. What was Abraham's response? Then he believed in the Lord, and he, God, reckoned it to him as right. Abraham believed the promise that God made him. He told him, I am going to do this for you, and Abraham believed that he would do what he said he was going to do. And in Genesis we're told that God reckoned that belief to him as righteousness. That is, Abraham was okay with God. Abraham was in the right with God because he was the kind of man who, when God made a promise to him, he believed it. Even as hard to believe as this promise might come to be, because the fact is, Abraham gets older and older and his wife is barren and, you know, this thing doesn't look like it's going to be happening. This is the passage that both James and Paul refer to. Paul's point is pretty easy to understand. He's saying, look, here's Abraham. It is because he believes what God told him that he is right with God. And he's making the comparison with that and the gospel, the proclamation of Jesus as the Messiah, the salvation that Jesus has come to bring, that believing that Jesus can and will do what he has said he will do, he's making equivalent to Abraham believing this promise from God. We're right with God the same way. If we're the sort of people who believe what God has told us, then we're in the right with God. That's Paul's point. James' point is a little trickier to understand. And in order to understand it, we have to keep going. Because James doesn't only refer to this, he refers to an event that happens after this, significantly after this. And in order to understand James' point, we need to put together some more of the picture. So, let's move on. Years go by, and Abraham, Christians debate whether Abraham was faithless in doing this, or it was just part of the culture and he didn't even think about it, or, you know, there can be all kinds of debates as to whether Abraham was in the right or not in what he did. And I've heard arguments on both sides. But however you look at it, what Abraham did was he took the handmaiden of his wife and had relations with her so that she, who was not barren, could give birth to his child. So, this was by his wife's permission. She says, you know, I can't give you a child, so I'm going to give you my handmaiden, and she will bear you a child. And Ishmael is the name of the child who was born. The child from Abraham's body. Now remember the promise that had been made to him. God said, a child from your body will be the foundation of this great nation. So in Abraham's mind, this is, hey, great. I've got the kid. This is the kid that God promised from my body. And so later on in Genesis 17, we see Abraham in another conversation with God saying, oh, that Ishmael might live before you. A very cryptic comment, live before you. But in the context of Genesis, it's pretty clear what Abraham has in mind. This is the kid, right? Oh, that Ishmael might be the one who lives before you. In other words, who your eye is upon, your blessing is upon, you take him and you prosper him and you make a nation of him. This is the kid from my body, right? Here he is. Oh God, please go for it. Give him that blessing and make the great nation from him. And God says to him, no, but Sarah your wife shall bear you a son, and you shall call his name Isaac, and I will establish my covenant with him for an everlasting covenant for his descendants after him. Okay, God saying, look, I told you it was going to be a kid through your body, and that's right. But it's not a kid that you have with your wife's handmaiden. This is going to be a kid that you have with your wife. Your wife is going to give birth to a son. And his name is going to be Isaac. Isaac, not Ishmael. Ishmael is your kid, and I'll treat him well because he's your kid, but he is not the one. He is not the one that I am making this covenant with. I made you a promise about making you a great nation, but it is not Ishmael that I'm going to do that with. It's Isaac. Isaac, who at this point does not exist. This is a promise from God that your wife, your old barren wife, is going to give birth to a son. And he is going to be the fulfillment of the promises that I have been making you all along. Okay. So, things move along, and what do you know? Sarah has a son. Barren, aged Sarah has a child, and they name him Isaac. Funny thing. God said he was going to be called Isaac, and he gives them the kid, and they decide, well, maybe we better name him Isaac. So they did. Isaac, the child that God has promised, has been born. This is the one. God is going to make a great nation of Abraham through Isaac. Isaac is the one that God is making the covenant with. He's the one that God is making this commitment. Ishmael is one thing, but Isaac, he's the one. He is going to found a great nation. I'm going to bless him. I'm going to bless you through him. I'm going to bless all the world through him. That's the guy, Isaac. That then leads us to what I have often described as in my mind, one of the most significant things that ever happened in the history of the world. I mean, you have to get the right perspective on this. I mean, I'm comparing this to stuff like, you know, World War II and Columbus discovers America and, you know, the whole deal. I'm saying this event here, if you look at it from the perspective that God has given us about what are the significant things that have happened in the world, this is one of the truly significant things that ever happened. God tests Abraham. Now, it came about after these things that God tested Abraham and said to him, Abraham. And he said, Here I am. And he said, take now your son, your only son, whom you love, Isaac, and go to the land of Moriah, and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I will tell you. This is a very troubling and problematic verse for us when we come across it, because what sort of picture of God do we get here? I mean, God is the one who forbid the Israelites later on to have anything to do with the religions around them that used to practice child sacrifice and other horrible things like that. And yet here is God saying to Abraham, I want you to take Isaac up on the mountaintop and sacrifice him to me. Very, very troubling. Well, we have one clue as to what's going on here. The text says that God tested Abraham. This was some sort of a test. What is absolutely essential for us to understand in this story is what kind of a test was it? What was it that was being tested? Like, you could imagine a situation where you wanted to join a gang, and in order to join this gang, they say to you, okay, we want to test whether you're the right material to be in our gang. So, I hear you had a kid with that lady down the street. I want you to take the kid, take your switchblade and kill him. You do that, we'll know that you're the right stuff for our gang. Well, that would be a test. That would test something about the person who was being tested there. It would also say an awful lot about the ones who were administering the test, what their values were and what they were into. Unless the Bible is just absolutely mistaken that there is no God or that God is essentially evil, it doesn't seem likely that that's the point. I mean, even if it is mistaken, it doesn't seem likely that that's the point that the biblical authors want to make, is that God is like this awful, horrible being who delights in the death of children or something like that. So the question is, what's being tested? What kind of a test is Abraham going through? Well, we're going to have to explore that question here. Let's see what happens. What happens is Abraham, as you probably have heard this story before, Abraham takes Isaac up on the mountaintop and basically lays him out and lifts his hand to do what God had told him to do. And at the last moment, God stops him and says, no, I don't want you to do this. I just wanted to know what you would do. And here's what he says. Then the angel of the Lord called to Abraham a second time from heaven. The first time he said, stop, don't do this. The second time he says, by myself I have sworn, declares the Lord, because you have done this thing and have not withheld your son, your only son. Indeed, I will greatly bless you, and I will greatly multiply your seed as the stars of the heavens and as of the sand which is on the seashore. And your seed shall possess the gate of their enemies. And in your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed, because you have obeyed my voice. Okay. Basically here, God repeats, with a little addition, but fundamentally he repeats the promise that he had made to Abram back before Abraham did anything. This is the promise he made to him when he wasn't even living in the land of Canaan. He says, I'm going to give you a land, I'm going to make you great, and through you all of the families of the earth will be blessed. Basically, God repeats that promise. By myself I have sworn. God is swearing by himself. By my own name I am swearing and saying that I am going to do what I promised to do because you have obeyed my voice. So the interesting thing is that at the beginning, Abraham was given basically an unconditional promise. I'm going to do this thing. And then here, after he has passed the test, God says to him, I am going to do this thing that I have promised because you passed the test, because you have obeyed my voice. Well, it's interesting. As we're thinking about this struggle between James and Paul over whether you're justified by faith or justified by works, it has to be interesting to us to look at this and see, if James and Paul had never brought it up at all, we would be asking the question of this text about what the relationship is between faith and obedience. Because Abraham believes God, and it was reckoned to him as righteousness, and yet here God is saying it's because you obeyed my voice that these things are going to happen. So, the Old Testament story itself, before we even get into Paul and James, is painting an interesting sort of picture of the relationship between the faith that Abraham had and that justified him many years earlier, and this thing that he did when he was tested, which God says is the grounds for his being blessed. So, it's striking. James says that the one is fulfilled by the other. That doesn't seem like such an amazing claim for James to make, because as we read the story, there sure does seem to be some kind of a relationship here between them. We're left with the story ourselves wondering, what's the relationship between this faith that Abraham had that justified him and this obedience that justified him? How do we put those things together? James is saying there's a connection. Well, I think that if we were to just stop and think about it for a while, we could probably get there to make the connection, to see what's the nature of this test and what exactly is it that's being demonstrated and what's the connection between them. I've always been grateful that God didn't leave us with this important issue to sort that out entirely on our own, because the author of Hebrews makes a comment about this very question that's very, very significant, I think. So here I'm going to jump into the New Testament. By the way, as we're doing all of these things, you'll remember last week I talked about there are things like concordances, big books that basically show you if there's a particular word, I want to know where is all the places Where are all the places that this word is used in the Bible? That there are books or Bible software, all kinds of things that you can use to find those places? The sort of thing I'm doing here is really handy to find these sort of things by taking one of those kind of books. And in this case, it's pretty obvious. Paul is talking about Abraham. James is talking about Abraham. How did I find all this stuff? I went and looked up all the places in the Bible that talk about Abraham to see if there was any clue, any discussion there that would help. This one in Hebrews 11 seems to me to be, this is A number one wins the prize, most helpful place in the Bible, besides the actual story itself about Abraham, that makes some sort of a comment that helps us sort it out. It says in Hebrews 11, 17, by faith Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac. And he who had received the promises was offering up his only begotten son. It was he to whom it was said, in Isaac your descendants shall be called. He considered that God is able to raise men even from the dead, from which he also received him back as a type. Okay, now, in Hebrews, the author of Hebrews in chapter 11 tells the story of a number of Old Testament figures. And the point that he makes throughout is that each of these people demonstrated their faith by what they did. By faith, this person did this. By faith, Sarah let the spies go out. By faith, this figure did X, Y, and Z. A whole series of people that he talks about, basically to make the point that the people who have been in God's favor throughout, as you look at the whole story, the ones who have been in God's favor have always been those who believed what God told them. When God said something was true, they believed it and they acted on it because they believed it. So he tells this story about Abraham. When he was tested, he offered up Isaac. Now, his next comments are very, very significant. He who had received the promises was offering up his only begotten son. He who had received the promises, that's important. Abraham was not just a guy like me that God came to one day and said, I want you to take Brian up on a mountain and kill him. If that had happened, I mean, I would have reason, first of all, to doubt whether this was really God that was talking to me. But you understand, in that situation, all I have is some guy coming to me saying, kill somebody else. That's all that's really involved. It's just, I want you to off that guy. And I'm like, you do? What am I supposed to do with that? That's not who Abraham is. Abraham is the guy who has received the promises. What does he know about Isaac? He knows God has promised him that he is going to found a great nation, that all the families of the earth are going to be blessed through him, and so on. He knows that that's going to come about through a child of his own body. He knows that it is not Ishmael, but it is the child that he has through Sarah, and his name is Isaac. In other words, he knows that the child right there in front of him that God is saying to kill is the one that God has said is going to found a great nation. His covenant is with Isaac, he has said. God has made a promise. I have made a covenant, that an agreement, that I am going to bless Isaac. Not just Abraham, but Isaac in particular. God has promised. Isaac is the one that God is saying, I want you to take him up on the mountain and sacrifice him to me. Well, notice what the author of Hebrews says. He points out, it was he, Abraham, to whom it was said, in Isaac your descendant shall be called. That's what he's pointing out. Abraham is the guy who had already heard God say, Isaac is the one. Isaac is the one that is going to found this nation. Your descendants are going to be called children of Isaac. He's going to give the name to the whole group. So the one that Abraham is being asked to kill is the one that he also knows that God has promised must live. Isaac has to live. He's only a kid at this point. I mean, I forget how old he is, but he doesn't have any kids yet, which is the significant thing. He's got to go on and have at least one kid of his own, because somewhere along the line, we've got to get this nation stuff started. And somebody's going to have at least more than one kid somewhere along the line here, or this isn't going to work. So Isaac has to live. God has promised, I have made my covenant. Isaac is the one who is going to found all of this stuff. So the author of Hebrews says, he considered that God is able to raise men even from the dead, from which he also received him back as a type. I don't have anything to say about the type thing at the moment, but what we want to look at is he considered that God is able to raise men even from the dead. His offering of Isaac was not, God isn't testing, so how low will you go for me, Abraham? You know, will you kill your kid for me, Abraham? Go up there and kill your kid for me, Abraham. See if you'll go that low. That isn't it. Back here, let's see, for you guys, back here, the past is always on the left, right? Back here, back there, God had said, I am going to give you all of these descendants, as many as the stars in the sky. If you can count them, then you can count how many descendants you're going to have. And Abraham believed him. Now, God was saying, give me back the kid. Here he is. This is the child that I have promised. Give him back to me. And Abraham, why is he willing to do it? The author of Hebrews makes it explicit. He believes that God is going to keep the promises that he made. This is the child that is going to fulfill those promises. So, you know, all along, God said, you're going to have a kid through your wife. I didn't know how that could happen, but it happened. God did that. So now God is saying, I want you to take him and sacrifice him to me. If God says that's the way it has to be, okay. Because I know that God doesn't mean that he's going to die. I mean, this can't be the end of the story for Isaac, because Isaac is the point of the whole thing. Isaac is the one who has to live. I could die at this point and things would be okay, but Isaac can't die because Isaac is the one through whom the promise is coming. So, for Abraham, his willingness to offer Isaac was based on the reality of his faith. He believed that God was going to keep the promises that he made. That's why he was willing to do what he did. Okay? All of that, I mean, I admit I've been influenced by what James says and what I have said here, but fundamentally, everything we've talked about here is based on going back and looking at the story of Abraham and trying to make sense of that story with a help from a few comments from the New Testament about what's going on there. I would argue that that's what the story about Abraham's offering up Isaac is all about. It is about a test of what? A test of his faith. He said back here, I believe you. You tell me I'm going to have all of these descendants? I believe you. And he was justified because he believed God. To be a person who believes God's promises is to be right with God. Down the line, God tests that faith by asking him to offer up Isaac. His obedience there was acting on, living out, the implications of what he said he believed back there. He said he believed that God was going to do it, and here, what he chose to do was based on whether, in fact, he really believed that God was going to do what he said he was going to do. Okay, well, now, James just falls into place when you get that picture. What does he say? Was not Abraham our father justified by works when he offered up Isaac his son on the altar? You see that faith was working with his works, and as a result of the works, faith was perfected. Fulfilled, which says, and Abraham believed God, and it was reckoned to him as righteousness. In the James 2 section, he says, the scripture was fulfilled. What was the scripture that was fulfilled? The scripture was fulfilled was the one back in Genesis 15. God promises him lots of kids, and he believes him. Abraham believed God, and it was reckoned to him as righteousness. That is a statement about Abraham's justification. Does James know that? Yes, he knows it. That's his point in the passage. Back here in the past, he was justified with God because he believed. What does his action later on of being willing to offer up Isaac do? It fulfills what was said back here. Now, this is an interesting use of the word fulfill. In fact, it's very helpful to us as we try to understand the concept of fulfillment in the New Testament. Because it's not that this was a prediction. It's not like this said, this passage in Genesis 15 says, one day you will offer up your son on a mountain. And then, sure enough, he did it, and so it was fulfilled, what it says back here. No. This was a statement that said Abraham believed God, and he was justified before God because of it. That's what was fulfilled here. What was implicit in what went on here, Abraham in his head, and maybe with his mouth, said, I believe this. It was an internal decision that he made. I believe this. Years later, when God tested him, he had to act on it. He had to actually make a decision and do something that was based on what he believed, what he had truly and genuinely believed before. It's not that he was faking it before, he genuinely believed it. But here was a chance to actually act on it. And when he was willing to offer up Isaac, it fulfilled what had been said of him back here, that he believed God. Therefore, James can say, that's why he says, was not Abraham our father justified by works when he offered up Isaac his son on the altar? What he's saying is, his argument is, he was justified by faith in this passage in 15, but his actions that are described in 22 are the fulfillment of that faith. It shows the reality of the faith that he said he had back here. So was Abraham justified by faith? Yes. But James' point, I would argue, is he was justified by a faith that led him to do something at a certain point. He wasn't justified by a faith that didn't act. He was justified by a faith that did act. In the Abraham story, what we see is Abraham's choice to act, to offer up Isaac, is based on what he believes. So the connection here, the point that James is trying to make from the story of Abraham, is when you have a faith in what God promises you, it's the sort of thing that is going to have an impact on what you do. If you believe that something is true, you're going to act as if that were true. Not all the time. Do we always act consistently with what we believe? No. We wrestle. We can be very inconsistent. But sooner or later, if we genuinely believe the gospel, then something about the way we choose to live is going to reflect the fact that we believe the gospel. James, in his letter, is trying to deal with the argument that somehow I could say, well, I believe this, I believe that Jesus is the Messiah, and yet have that belief make no difference at all in the way I live. Is James arguing that if you're a believer, then you never sin? No. In fact, I think it makes it pretty clear, actually, that it's quite possible that we would sin along the way. That's not his point. But his point is, when I look at you guys, when I see the way you're living and the decisions you're making, if I didn't know that you had said you believe the gospel, I would think that you don't believe the gospel, because the way you live is exactly the way a person who doesn't believe the gospel would live. And see, I have a hard time believing or knowing what you mean by a faith that never has any impact on what you do. That's his whole thing in chapter 2. What use is it, my brethren, if a man says he has faith but he has no works? Can that faith save him? Someone may well say, you have faith and I have works. Show me your faith without the works, and I will show you my faith by my works. I mean, that's the issue he's raising there. Okay, so I know what I would mean. I mean that I believe this, as in I'm counting on it, and I'm living as if it's true. You're telling me that you believe it, but somehow that belief is invisible. It has had no impact at all on the way you live. Saying, I don't know. I have a hard time knowing what you mean by that. What kind of a belief is it that is so hidden that it has no impact on the way you live? You know, I believe I'm dying of hunger, and I believe that food is behind that door, and I just never get around to going and opening the door. He said, are you hungry? Yeah. Oh, man, am I hungry. You believe the food's behind the door? Yeah, it's right back there. And? And you just stand there. You just never, ever open the door and go in and... It calls something into question. Are you really hungry? Do you really believe that it's back there? Because I can't make any sense of how you wouldn't choose to do this if you, in fact, believe what you say you believe. Okay, so... This is the point that I'm trying to make here. The big theological point is the relationship between faith and works. And what I would argue is that there is no inconsistency between Paul and James, because what Paul is arguing for is that I am right with God not by virtue of my works of righteousness, because I'm a sinner who doesn't deserve God's approval. I am justified by what Jesus did on the cross, and it is those who believe in that, who have faith in that, that will find salvation in the end. It is the mercy of God. The emphasis there is on the mercy of God. For James, he's dealing with a different problem. He's dealing with people who said, oh yeah, yeah, we believe that, and then they just cruise on as if it's not true. And what he's getting at is, yeah, it's faith that justifies us, but it's not a faith that is invisible. It's a faith that is real. It's a real faith with real content to it. And when you have a real faith, sooner or later it's going to make a difference when you do things. You're going to live differently because you believe that's true. Does Paul believe that? I think we could go back into Paul's letters. I could make a case for you from Paul's letters that he believes the same thing, that what you believe has an impact on the way you live. In fact, a whole letter like 1 Corinthians that we started to look at the beginning of this class reflects Paul's belief that the way they're living has an awful lot and pretty scary implications for what it is they're really believing. Paul believes the same thing. What you believe is going to come out in the choices that you make ultimately. But Paul is talking about the question, can I earn my salvation before God by keeping the law? And his answer is no, I can't. James is talking about the question, can I say I have faith if it means so little to me that I never choose to act on it at all? And he's saying, well, no, you really can't. Paul and James would agree on that, I think. That's the theological question. That's, I think, how those two things would be reconciled. And there's an awful lot that we could say about that. And in fact, Well, like I have said before, that question has been one of the primary questions of my life as a student of the Bible, trying to put those things together. So it's a very important question to me. Life and death, essential theological issue. Having said all of that, my main purpose tonight was to demonstrate how much difference it can make if we go back and try to become familiar with the Old Testament background to the things that we're reading in the New Testament. I would argue that it is very hard to know what James is talking about in that section if you don't go back and become familiar with the whole story of Abraham's life. If you don't go back and do that, it's not that you couldn't get there, but in a way you'd be guessing. You really have to go back and look at it and follow it through in order to understand the point that James is making. And that's the point that I wanted to make tonight. As students of the Bible, when we're reading the New Testament and you see one of those things that's in all capital letters that says it's from the Old Testament, you really, really would be well advised to say to yourself, well, my work has just gotten a little bigger, because I have another passage to deal with as well as the one I'm looking at, which is the one that it's quoting. What is it doing? Now, this one, I mean, obviously, I pick them for a reason, right? This one is relatively easy to see what's going on. There are passages that we could pick, and you'd go back and go, I don't get what the Old Testament passage is doing, and I don't get what the New Testament passage is doing, either one of them. And I didn't pick one of those because it wouldn't have made the point as well. But I would say that in essence, it's the same thing. What that means is I just haven't done the work yet of getting in and figuring out what's going on with those passages. But that's what's required. Is ultimately, I can't really be happy with an interpretation of a New Testament passage if it refers to the Old Testament. I can't really feel settled about what I'm seeing there until I understand what's happening in both places. Because when I understand what's happening in both places, then I can have the confidence that I see the point that the New Testament author is making from the Old Testament. And there can be a variety of points that a New Testament author can make from the Old Testament. Sometimes the New Testament author, I don't believe, is actually using the Old Testament to prove anything. He's jumping off and making another point altogether. But in order to discover that, you have to go and look at the Old Testament passage and put them together and try to see how it fits. Okay, so that's the point I wanted to make tonight. I hope it was clear enough. We have some time for any comments or questions. Yes, sir, in the corner.
In respect to works, could you make a distinction between the effects of sanctification versus conformity to the Christian culture?
Well, yes, I think so. Because the issue is what has given rise to what I'm doing. And the Bible is concerned ultimately with the heart. The Pharisees did lots of things right. I mean, the Pharisees didn't do everything wrong. I mean, we look back, we know that Jesus was very harsh on the Pharisees, and Paul was very harsh on the Pharisees, even though he had been one himself, maybe especially because he had been one himself. But a lot of what the Pharisees did was not bad. The choices they made in a lot of cases were the right choices. If you and I had been there and saying, here's the choices before us, what should we do? I think that we would have done the same thing that the Pharisee chose to do in that spot. And yet, their hearts were not, I'm not saying all of them, but those that Jesus was criticizing, those that Paul was criticizing, their hearts were not right. They were not basically, they didn't see themselves as sinners in need of God's mercy, fundamentally. I mean, they would have admitted to being sinners, but they didn't really have that idea that they were totally at the mercy of God, and so on. Any number of truths about who God was and who they were, they weren't accepting. Well, that same thing can be true now. It's not just an outward conformity to what a particular religious culture hands me. I mean, the Christian culture around me can hand me good ideas about how you ought to live. It can hand me irrelevant things, things that are neither here or there, but are a part of the culture as it has come together. It can hand me bad things. It can hand me things that are really not in keeping with what God is calling us to. My conformity to the Christian culture, there are a lot of reasons why I might conform to it. I want to be accepted. I want to be approved of by, I like this group of people and I want them to think highly of me, so I'm going to conform to it. All of that can be quite irrelevant to whether I have actually personally decided that there is a God and I need His mercy and I believe that He is offering it in Christ. So, the real working out of my faith is going to look like, I think, you can start to see in the Bible, it starts to paint a picture of what some of that would look like. One of the things that characterizes it, just as an example, is coming to be a merciful person. Coming to be a person who can recognize the faults of others and be forgiving of them. And why is that? Well, the Bible talks about it. Because I know that I am a person at fault before God. God is being merciful to me. I'm not getting what I deserve. I'm getting mercy instead. So how can I turn around then and deny mercy to someone else when I am so much in need of it myself? Well, the Pharisees as a group were not a merciful group of people, by and large. And that had to do with the fact that fundamentally they didn't see themselves as needing the mercy of God. Well, the same thing, I think you can make a difference between some parts of some Christian cultures that I could become a part of. You can see that the cultural environment is actually not particularly merciful. We have our standard for what it's supposed to look like, and if you aren't measuring up, then you don't really fit in, and we don't want you there. So there are these kind of touch points where you might see that there's a difference between the two. Now, I think they're going to line up in some places, because it would be pretty amazing that a culture would grow up calling itself Christian that was totally unchristian in every point of contact. I don't think that's likely to happen. But that there could be differences, sure. Now, you understand, I'm not indicting any particular culture or group of people. We have, when we talk about Christian culture, it's actually not monolithic. I mean, there are different cultures that we're dealing with. All I'm saying is, I think your question is a really good one, Toby, because when we're talking about the kind of works that James is talking about, he's not saying, go out and do something to prove that you're one of the good guys. That's not what he's saying. He's saying, to them in particular, what he's saying is, you know, I know that you're suffering at the hands of those who are wealthy. But if you were to decide that, therefore, that what you really need in this world is to get even wealthier so you can turn around and beat the tar out of them, then you have profoundly misunderstood what your problem is and what the solution to it is. Okay, so for them, I mean, it was confronting the reality of God's promises. God is merciful. God has this great thing for me. I can trust Him to do it. I'm like a farmer who's tilling the ground, expecting that one day the harvest is going to come in. That's what my life is like. So it's that, the testing of my faith and the works that result from it have to do with, do I believe that God exists? Do I believe that I'm a sinner? Do I believe that goodness and righteousness is a good thing? It's what life ought to be about. Do I believe that my eternal destiny in the kingdom of God is the most important issue that I face and all of that? That's going to have an effect on how I live. It can also have an effect on how I live. Gee, at my school, the Christian youth groups are the coolest guys on campus, and I really want to be accepted by them, so I think I'm going to do what they say to do. It might end up looking somewhat the same at certain spots, but they're coming from two very different motives, and the Bible is very concerned with motives. So that's my long answer to your question. Yeah.
Like you said, sometimes in the New Testament, the authors will just take a verse out and say, start from there, and make some other point that has nothing to do with it. It seems like they should have had one of these studies or something. If I take them as an example for how I should look at Scripture, then I can do whatever I want with it, or whatever I think the Spirit is leading me to do with it. But it's not a very good exegetical example to look at the New Testament for how they look at Scripture. Can you address the one?
Yes, that's a very, very important question. Really, really important question that you're raising. And I know I can't address it because it's so big, but let me just say I 100% agree with you. Something's got to give somewhere. I mean, if the New Testament authors are in fact a model of an entirely different way of approaching the Bible than I'm saying that we ought to approach the Bible, then something's wrong. And maybe one of the things is wrong is, I don't know what I'm talking about. You shouldn't be listening to me, because that's what we should be doing is what the New Testament authors did, which was sometimes it seems like, man, they went in all kinds of directions. What I can say is this. I have been very interested in the question of the New Testament use of the Old Testament for a long time, and have tried along over the years to kind of hammer away at, you know, this passage and this passage, trying to understand how the New Testament authors did that. I'm convinced right now that their exegesis is not weird, and it's not any different than what I'm arguing for. Now, can I demonstrate that to be the case in every single example? Well, I'm only 47 years old, and I've only had so many years to think about this. But in general, I think when you stop and look at it carefully, when you look at the Old Testament passages, when you start to get a feel for the kinds of points that the Old Testament is making and the way it's making those points, that what the New Testament authors sometimes are doing, I mean, sometimes I think they genuinely are making their own point. They're not actually saying, this text said this. And that would be one thing. But most of the time, I think they are taking us back and saying, there is a point that this text helps to establish. And the thing is that most of the time, they don't explain how it does it. They refer to it, and they take off, and they don't really talk about the passage. It looks like, in certain examples, that they are being... they're just playing fast and loose. They're not paying attention to what the original text meant. But I'm becoming more and more convinced as I look at that stuff that that's not the case. That it's just that there is a broader theological point that is arising from this text that they are drawing on and not really explaining how it is that they're getting there. Tonight, I was pointing to that example of James saying that the passage in Genesis fulfilled the later passage in Genesis. That's a very important passage for the point that I'm making here. This is a point that Jack made a number of years ago, and I think is a very good one, that we have the word fulfilled used in a number of places in the New Testament. You know, this fulfilled what it was said back here. But here's an example of James using that word where it has a richness that it's not just that was a prediction and this is when it happened, but here was a truth that is made implicit in this story that is filled out and finds its fruition in this story over here. Now, if we start to allow that, say, the word fulfill or something like that can have that kind of significance, then I would argue that in some of those problematic passages, like, we, in I can't remember if it's Hosea or Amos, I can't remember, but Matthew quotes the passage, "Out of Egypt I called my son," is one of those examples. When you go back and read it in the Old Testament, it's just abundantly clear that he is talking about God calling the Israelites out of Egypt, the Exodus, Moses and the Exodus, pulling them out. Matthew says that was fulfilled when Jesus and his family, when he's a baby, they have to flee to Egypt to get away from Herod. And when they're coming back, the angel tells them, okay, it's okay, Herod's dead, you can come back. And that fulfills, "Out of Egypt I called my son." Well, I mean, we face into it right there. I mean, there's only like a couple of possibilities. Number one, the passage is talking about one thing, Matthew isn't paying any attention to what it's talking about and makes it say something else just because he wants to. Number two, somehow we want to say that the intention of the passage originally was to talk about Israel, but back in God's mind there's a hidden deeper meaning that Matthew is coming along and saying, and this is what was in there, although how one would ever know it in reading the text you would never know. Or else third, and what I believe, Matthew is making not a simple sort of, that's a prediction that Jesus would do this sort of statement, but a deeper sort of theological connection between what God did in the Exodus and what he's doing with Jesus. That's the direction I would go. That's what I think he's doing. So, granted that then, I mean, maybe you won't grant me that, but for the sake of argument, you can see the direction that I would go in my thinking. I think that the New Testament authors rightly believe that the stories told in the Old Testament are very rich with implications for what kind of God God is and what his purposes are for his people and so on. And they're constantly making the connection between what God had done in the Old Testament and the fulfillment of that in the New Testament. God saved Israel out of Egypt in the Exodus and through the Red Sea and so on. I mean, he saved them. But in the end, what kind of salvation is that? I mean, they all died. It's not like he really saved them from their real problem. I mean, it was a problem they had and he saved them from it. But his being a God who saves his people, that's only just a shadowy sort of picture of God's salvation, of the kind of saving God that he is. Jesus dying on the cross for my sins, that's the real thing. That's what the real salvation looks like. And so I think the New Testament authors are making this connection. They're not imposing something on the text that wasn't there. What they're saying is, we learned this much about God back here, but now we see it in its fullness. And so there's this connection between what we saw hinted at in the story back here and the fullness of it here. That is the kind of connection that I think the New Testament authors make a lot. And I would say that's a legitimate one. It's a legitimate implication of the stories in the Old Testament. Especially when we remember, if you read the Old Testament very much, if you've ever had the experience, I don't know of any of you, if you've, you know, tried like, if you have quiet time or that kind of thing or something like that, but if you've ever tried to do devotional reading in a passage in the Old Testament, it's like, okay, so he went to this place and he did this and these armies came out and they killed him and you go through the story and you say, okay, so there's the story. There's the story. Abraham, he's going along with his wife Sarah. He comes into Egypt. He says, oh, I'm going to get in trouble. They're going to kill me because you're so beautiful. I'm going to say you're my sister. The Pharaoh takes her, marries her. God sends a plague on them. He says, what did you do? Why didn't you tell me she was your wife? And Abraham says, well, I was afraid. And he says, well, look, let me give you a whole bunch of stuff and you go away. Leave. Okay, so there's amen, that's right. Preach it. So what exactly What exactly is the point of that? If I read that in my quiet time, what is that telling me? What am I supposed to do? Am I supposed to go out and lie about whether I'm married or not? Is that the key to finding blessing? What exactly is the point of that? Well, I think that there is a point ultimately to that stuff, but it is a point that emerges from, sometimes you have to look at the kind of the whole scope, the whole story of Abraham's life to kind of see how it works. And then how does Abraham fit into the larger story of Israel's history? An awful lot of times a story is told and it doesn't even mention God. But is God out of the picture? Well, I don't think so. He's back there. He's like the whole point of the story. But the author, in telling the story in the Old Testament, doesn't even mention him. It's that sort of... those stories in the Old Testament, they are there deliberately. The facts of the story are spelled out, and we're left to put the picture together of what's the significance of this. Because of that, we can see how the New Testament authors might be quoting a passage from the Old Testament, and they're saying, when you go and look and you figure out what the deal is with all of this, it actually does speak to the thing I'm talking about. But you have to put it together. You have to see the whole picture in order to make that work. What's very interesting to me about the book of Hebrews is that it's really one of the only books in the New Testament where the author actually goes in at times and explains how he's making his points from the Old Testament texts. He actually explains what he thinks those texts mean. Now, those explanations can be challenging in and of themselves in Hebrews, but actually when you start to work with them, they're very helpful. And they kind of give you a feel for how they tended to work with this stuff. So anyway, there's another long answer. And I agree with you absolutely. I ought to be deeply embarrassed to be saying this stuff in the light of how the New Testament authors use the Old Testament, but I'm not. Because I don't think they're doing that. But I would have to prove that. I was just reading the other day, I have a book by Walter Kaiser that is about that topic, the New Testament use of the Old Testament, and I was looking through that, and you know, these are my delusions of grandeur. I was thinking about someday how I would like to write a book on that topic, because I think it would be interesting. It's a very interesting topic to me. And it does help us with having confidence in that the Bible's not playing fast and loose, too. This is totally off the topic, but it just occurred to me, I think it's so interesting, I wanted to mention it to you. We're talking here about, you know, having confidence in the Bible. I have this guilty secret. I have this habit that I've fallen into of every now and again I get on the internet and I go find websites that are anti-Christian, you know, that are you know, skeptics, Bible errors, here's why Christians are fools to believe in the gospel kind of sites. And it's kind of like, you know, all right, I'm game, take your best shot. You know, I want to know. I don't want to be a fool. If I'm a fool to believe the gospel, then tell me so. And the striking thing about it to me is that it's a very encouraging thing to do. If you've been a student of the Bible as long as I have, it's a very faith-building thing to do because their arguments are so stupid. they're so proud of themselves. You know, oh man, the Bible's so filled with errors. I mean, look at this and look at this and look at this. And you kind of go and say, my gosh. I mean, I could do better than this. I could come up with a better argument against Christianity than these guys are making. You know. It's,
did you email them and give them the answers?
No.
Suggestions.
It does cross my mind that looking at that stuff, there's part of you that kind of wants to say, somebody ought to jump in there and say something to all of this. But in actuality, it's like, you know, I think there are, I think there are non-Christians. I don't mean to disparage non-Christians. I think there are non-Christians who have thought about the issues and are more thoughtful than the kind of thing that I'm talking about. I'm not saying that anybody who disbelieves in Christianity has no good reason for thinking so. I mean, there are good arguments that need to be addressed. But those kind of skeptical sites are usually I think of them as kind of like the Flat Earth Society or something like that. I mean, they're just people who just like to argue. They just love being right about stuff. And there would be no point in really trying to make an argument with them, because it's just, you know, I'm looking for some glimmer in somebody, some glimmer of hope that they're actually interested in talking about it. You know, and if they are, then I think we ought to be willing to do that. But they don't look like it to me.
Since you have your point,
yeah, sorry.
You raised the scripture about Abraham and Sarah.
Mm-hmm.
Could you help us out with what you think that point is?
I'm sorry, no, which one about Abraham and Sarah?
Oh, sorry. Can Sarah think he was just her sister and just came back here twice?
Right.
So, could you help us out with what you think is going on?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. I'm not sure. Actually, it's something I've been thinking about recently because of a class I'm taking right now on the Old Testament. And the teacher of this class has made this argument about the passage. If you look at it, there are an awful lot of parallels in the story, at least in the first time, between Abraham's situation and Israel's situation. Remember, if Moses is writing the Pentateuch, he is obviously writing it in the wilderness. He doesn't make it into the Promised Land, so he's writing it while he's traveling around in the wilderness with Israel. And the story about Abraham, he goes into Egypt with Sarah. Sarah is taken into captivity. God intervenes in her captivity by sending plagues upon the Egyptians. Pharaoh says, okay, she can go, and he piles lots of riches on Abraham as he's leaving, which parallels the story of Israel in their being captives in Egypt. God sends plagues, Pharaoh lets them go, and they plunder the Egyptians as they go by taking their jewels and that kind of stuff.
Except it misses the whole point of Abraham being a sinner or unfaithful.
Yes. Well, yes. Yes. But see, that's from the perspective of the guy that I'm taking his class from. He's saying we get distracted by that issue of the ethical issue of Abraham lying. Well, no, he's not that it isn't an important issue, but what he's saying is it is not the issue that Moses has on his mind. He's saying, yeah, that's an interesting question to talk about Abraham's lying and whether he should have. But he's saying the point that's being made in the story is about God's faithfulness. Whether Abraham was a liar or not, God was faithful to deliver him and pull him out of the situation better off than he went into it, which is what happened to Israel in their situation as well. I mean, you could say that the ethics enter into it and that Abraham doesn't particularly prove himself worthy in that situation of such blessing, and neither did Israel in theirs, but God did it anyway. So I don't know. But that's, you can see the line of, I'm not sure what I think about that argument. I'm still thinking about it. But you can see that there's actually a lot of room for, I do think that this teacher is right in saying that we need to be careful, that we can get very interested in the question, like, should Abraham have lied in this situation? But we need to be careful to if we're trying to figure out what the text is saying, to make sure that we're not making more of that question than was intended. That might not really be the point. The point might be on what God did more than on what Abraham did. And that's a good point. I'm not sure what I think about the argument. Yeah.
On that line, have you heard or are you familiar with that Sarah might have actually even been Abraham's half-sister, or have you ever heard that before?
I think, yeah, I have heard that. And why have I heard that? Doesn't he say that? He says.
She says it.
Yes, I think somewhere in his explanation, he's basically saying, well, it's technically true.
And so, yeah. I mean, that would go along with your point that we see it as an ethical, well, he was lying, but he wasn't, I mean, it comes back to kind of like the Ishmael thing. He wasn't
wasn't really lying, or it wasn't, you know, it's kind of, it had parallels of being a half-truth, and it's not really, the issue is, like you said, God working in it, because he didn't really lie
right
there.
Well, it's certainly possible that that's the case. If we're gonna explore the ethics of it, the question of a half-truth about my wife that leads another guy to marry her does raise the question as to whether somewhere along the line maybe the full truth would have been a little more appropriate. But that's...
But I mean, in that parallel, it kind of has to do with God said, well, it'll be of you, like with Ishmael or something like that. So in Abraham's, Abraham's thinking, right, it creates a situation where it was of him.
Right.
Just like, you know, in that situation, and it botched the whole, it kind of, you know, through a swing, you know, it presented a situation where his wife got married, just like where it presents a situation where Ishmael, because isn't Ishmael the father of the Muslims and being a thorn in the side of Israel?
I think you could make the case that Ishmael is presented as the descendant of the originator of the Arabic peoples. Yes, I think. I am no expert on, let's see, but I think that's what they say, isn't it? I mean, I know they claim Abraham.
They claim Ishmael.
And yeah, I think they would accept that picture. Okay, yeah, so anyway, in terms of the question of what was going on in that story, I'm not sure yet. I'm with you though, Denise. I tend to think that if we were to try to put those things together, I think I would want to put them together along the lines of, here's Abraham trying to, you know, he's afraid and he's trying to deal with the situation, and it's really not a real great idea that he's got. But God is faithful to him and preserves him in this situation anyway. I mean, he goes to bat for him even in a situation that he created. But I'm not sure. I'm still thinking about that. The Old Testament is challenging, partly because we don't have an explanation of what the point of the story is.
She's going to say it also seems that it puts a whole generational thing of deceit in the whole line of Abraham, following on down, just like the sins of one generation are visited upon the other. Because in each generation there is that area of deceit that follows.
Right. 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 And in fact, similar things happen along the way. Okay, well, we've come to the end of our time and beyond. Thanks for coming.